All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. I hope everybody enjoyed those first two segments with Peter Buchvar. Always find Peter's analysis on the economy and the markets very interesting, especially the big picture takeaway, which I think is so important right now as we just keep on seeing these wild day-to-day, week-to-week swings, but still a lot of, I think, negativity around the markets and the economy. We're going to continue this more macroeconomic and market landscape commentary now with Mark Chandler. Mark is the managing partner at Bannockburn Global Forex, also editor of the Mark to Market website. And Mark, you're another guy that I go to actually on a weekly basis usually to get your take on what we're seeing in the economic data and also specific market moves, especially the large currency markets. The big shift from this Trump presidency is this, I think, shift away from the supply chains that have been built up in the U.S. or by U.S. companies, really benefiting from cheap labor in China and also other countries. That seems to be coming to an end. Again, it's maybe a little too early to say that, but boy, oh boy, we're getting a lot of pushback on where the U.S. has been getting their goods. So, Mark, how do you see this all playing out where these supply chains, they have been developed by a lot of U.S. companies over the past decades. Americans have benefited from these cheap goods coming in. What are the big changes you're seeing right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is the kind of time I think that we really need like a historical perspective. I think there's two ways traditionally that companies can service foreign demand. And that's important because just like credit cards allow us to live outside to beyond our means in many ways, global trade and exports or foreign demand allows us to live greater than our own aggregate demand. And so this has become, of course, what international relations and international competition is about. And so the traditional approach has been exporting. But after World War II, the strong dollar and protectionism, especially in Europe, encouraged U.S. companies to evolve their strategies. And the strategy was, instead of exporting the service growing European demand, it was going to be build locally, sell locally. And this is really what globalization under this sort of the Pax Americana means. Foreign direct investment, it's building plant and production outside your country. And that requires then, necessitates like a division of labor, supply chains, and then how those different nodes on the supply chain relate with each other, and that involves transfer pricing, internal pricing within a company, which allows or facilitates different tax strategies, but also protects your company from volatility in exchange rates. Because what happens is, instead of, for example, you're looking for an acquisition in a U.S. company looking for an acquisition in Germany. One way, which many of the banks would probably recommend, is you just go out and buy those euros. But if instead of buying the euros, you borrow them from a local bank, you in effect then have a euro liability and the euro asset you're buying, and you're neutral with currency movements. And so this strategy, this direct investment strategy, was how the U.S., I think, dominated to such a point that when records were first being kept in the early 1960s, already then, the sales by majority-owned U.S. affiliates, branches of U.S. companies abroad, were selling more, many times more than U.S. exports. But Europe and Japan, throughout the 60s and 70s, still had an export-led model. And that came to a head in the U.S. and Japan in the 80s and early 90s. And the combination of protectionism and the sharp appreciation of the yen driven by the Plaza Agreement forced Japanese companies to adopt that same direct investment strategy. Build cars in the U.S. Don't export them as much. And now I think that what President Trump is doing is saying that that strategy is no good. That strategy carves up the American middle class. We want to bring back production onshore. And to me, a couple problems is one, is we might be able to bring back production onshore, but it's not going to have a lot of jobs associated with it. Remember, only about 4% of Americans work in what's considered manufacturing. And out of that, only about half of that is really engaged in the production of goods. But because remember, if you're working at a say an auto parts company and you're a secretary or an accountant, you're working in a manufacturing company and your job is often considered manufacturing. And so I think that robotics, automation, AI is all going to make these modern factories, if we bring back production to the US, they'll make them so they're not really have a lot of employment associated with them. And also, I think it's that this idea of a direct investment strategy is really evolutionary. It's evolutionary in the sense that companies have to adapt to a changing international environment. And what's characterized the international environment, of course, is many small countries with their own trade rules, with their own rules about domestic content protectionism. And you have also wild, sometimes dramatic currency fluctuations. It's really cool to say, that currencies are free floating, or the market should determine them. But ultimately, what that means is that they're volatile. That's how companies and countries experience it. And so, a direct investment strategy allows this almost, I'd say, it's a evolutionary strategy that allows coping with a world in which you have a lot of different countries, high mobility of capital, and volatile exchange rates.
Mark, is it even plausible for the US to bring back a significant amount of manufacturing, even if it is automated and AI generated, so there aren't tons of jobs? Do you still see a shift coming even from the bigger companies? Simply because look at what Apple's doing. Instead of bringing back iPhone manufacturing to the US, they're just shifting it from China over to India.
Yeah, I suppose it's going to take some time to really sort this out. It probably is going to be company specific and industry specific. So some sectors might come home more. Some places that are more targeted, like semiconductor chips, pharma looks like it's going to be targeted. And so we might see some industries do come back onshore. And again, it's whether it's going to be job efficient. How much money is going to be spent? How many jobs are really be created?
And that is just what time will tell, right? We don't know how that's all going to play out. But in terms of what that means for currencies, that whole direct investment strategy, where does the US dollar fall in all this? Because it has been under pressure, but it's still right around that 100 level on the dollar index, which is still historically in the, let's say, higher range of trading. So what does that mean for the dollar in the big picture?
Yeah, I think that the dollar really tracks more Federal Reserve policy, interest rate policy, than it does these big macro, big picture things. I think that for investors, knowing sort of where we are in the big picture is helpful in terms of the broad picture and how the different variables can interact. But I'm still in the dollar bearish camp, but I did think that we have a bigger correction than we've had. To me, when I look at the dollar index, I see it peaking about a week before the inauguration. And that peak was really like a 3 or 4 month dollar rally that we had as the market was pricing in the Trump victory. And that was despite the Federal Reserve cutting interest rates. But the dollar index has been falling. It fell basically from the middle of January till like late April or so. But since then, I have been thinking that with the momentum indicators stretched, with a lot of the news priced in, and maybe the news is actually the real sector data coming out a little bit better. Not so much with that GDP number, which we know is distorted, but the jobs data seemed better than many people expected. But rather than really correct much higher, it seems to me that the dollar is broadly sideways. I had looked for that dollar index to go to 102, maybe 102 and a half, something like in that kind of area. And I thought that was conservative just based on retracements from the last leg down we had that began in late March. However, it's another week in which we saw, like the previous week, we get a good move on Thursday. Looks like a breakout, and then no follow-through ahead of the weekend. So I'm not ready to write it off that we're done with the dollar's upside. But I think what the general takeaway, I think, is that the market is demanding, because of the uncertainty, market's demanding a higher interest rate premium to stay long the dollar. And so I think that's partly what's happening is that even though the US rates have risen, not sufficiently to really compensate for the risk. And I think that is why we've seen a broad decoupling, say, of the dollar from the 10-year yield. or from the 2-year yield with against Germany, 10-year yield against Japan. So I'm concerned that in the big picture, we're still headed down for the dollar. And it's really right now whether we get a consolidation phase or whether it turns to an outright correction. So far, the dollar index has stayed below even minimum retracement levels.
Yeah, 102 or 103 level. I see that as being so critical on the chart because it was really a top for the dollar ever since, let's say, 2002, the whole way up to about 2022. So 20 years where 101 or 102, 103 was the peak that we saw. And now it's been trying to hold above, but again, it's been stuck below right now. Mark, so much of this policy seems like it's focused on China. Again, the big macro aspect here is trying to eliminate what China could do in terms of, I guess, taking more market share in the global world. However, it seems like a lot of these policies have just further pushed China to develop other trade agreements and also in the tech sector, develop their own tech sector in terms of chips, in terms of AI. Do you see this as, in a way, pushing China to make new deals to build up their own industry, which could come back to hurt the US?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a tricky situation, and here's why. I think that if you follow that my story about this foreign direct investment, here we are where China, it's not really exporting more than other countries. It's not as dependent, say, on exports as countries like Germany or Canada, for as far as big countries go. China exports less than 20% of its GDP, but because the China is so big, the scale is so it's daunting. And so I think that if we try to choke China off, and that is by denying it both strategies, by denying it exports, and that's through higher tariffs, and part of what we saw with the April trade data is that even though Chinese exports to the US fell sharply over a fifth, that Chinese exports to the rest of the world increased sufficiently to offset it in full. So that one point is that China export prowess continues. It's not exporting a large part of GDP, but it has found different sources of demand as it diversifies away from the US. But what concerns me is that the way we gave Japanese automakers the way out was building locally, selling locally. But because many people in the US, especially, think of China as the enemy, they don't want to open up the US to Chinese production. So instead of importing these goods from China, let them build it on a shore, like we're having Taiwan do with the semiconductor chips. But because of this ideological divide, many people are reluctant to do so. And the danger is that in these trade talks that the US has with various countries, it also builds up a bloc who's also against foreign direct investment by Chinese companies. And it's a bit like after World War I, Keynes writes an essay basically that talks about he says the economic consequences of peace, and he warns against the bleeding of Germany, not because he liked Germany, but because he knew that if these onerous demands were placed on Germany, it would not result in the kind of behavior that we hope for. And I think the same thing is true with China. If we block them from exporting and we block them from direct investment strategies, it's not going to lead to regime change in China. It's going to lead to more nationalism and more efforts to carve out their own sphere of influence. And so that's what concerns me, is that we're backing into a lesson that I think we should have learned before. We've got to make room for China at the table, or there's going to be greater disruption. And it's not, I'm not saying this, like I say, it's sort of like Keynes's attitude towards Germany. Not like he liked Germany, but he realized that real politics has certain dictates to it. So bottom line here is I am concerned that the confrontation with the US and China, that the trade talks that are scheduled for May 10th are not going to really go anywhere, that this is still going to lead to, even if, in the best case, the tariffs are cut in half. I think that 60, 70% tariffs would still be prohibitive and tantamount to an embargo between the two largest economies.
Seems like we've been seeing this for years now, though, with some of the embargoes that we've had on some Chinese goods, also the limiting of chips that the US was allowing Nvidia to send over them. it's made China develop their own chips and develop their own technology. And recently, we also had that Harvard professor that just went over to teach in China. So it almost seems like this shift, including the BRIC nation, some of these trade agreements that China's been coming up with, seems like this has been a long time coming, but it's almost speeding up right now. Are you seeing that as well?
Yeah, I think that maybe there has been a tipping point. Maybe the tipping point is that, say, up until now or up until the election, last year's election, that China was pushing the edge of the envelope in many ways. And I think that since Trump's election, we've seen not encroachment, but abdication, where the U.S. is leaving holes like it did when Trump pulled out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade agreement in East Asia. The U.S. has pulled out of the World Health Organization, the Paris Accord. I saw a story that said that the U.S. Is trying to get all companies, even foreign companies that do business with the federal government, to drop the DEI efforts. And so, to me, this is not a case of isolationism that some people claim, but it's really a case of unilateralism. And so, I think that in the big picture, that's what concerns me, is that I think it's been fairly straightforward that China could replace the demand caused by the US embargo. And it can replace the demand like we saw with the April trade numbers in other countries, or it could have more serious efforts to boost domestic demand at home. I think it's going to be harder for the US to replace the supply from China, even though it might take a while to see it, because businesses have built up inventories, critical earths, electronics, you name it. And so it might take a while, but I think that a bunch of things are sort of coming to fruition in next month, June or July. The cargo shipments that are now like leaving the West Coast ports empty, how that's going to filter through in the next 15 to 25 days to the Midwest and then the East Coast. I think about student loans having to be serviced again. I'm thinking about the drying up of foreign European and Canadian tourism to the U.S., besides boycotting US brands. I think, how long will the US businesses' inventories last, assuming they began building them up in March with the first, like February, with the first signs of tariffs? So 3 or 4 months, that should bring us probably to the summer as well. And that summer, of course, July, is when the reciprocal tariffs come back to the fore that haven't been negotiated away.
Yeah, what a big question mark. Hey, is when are these inventories going to dry up? And also, outside of China, I live in Canada, and all I am hearing, all I am reading, and even the businesses that I know up here, everyone is looking for different trade partners. They say that they would love to do business in the US because it is just easier for them, us being simply above, drive across the border, get your products down into the US, but it's been challenging for them. So, everybody, it seems like, at least in Canada, and also seems like around the world, are looking for other trade partners. What have you been hearing from any of your clients that are international that do have the ability, a bit more than just those US clients, to look outside of trading with the US and building up other trade agreements?
Yeah, no, our clients are mostly domestically based. But I think you're right. I think this is what we see in Canada. You know, for many years, people talked about Canada needs to diversify their exports away from the U.S. The U.S., I think, took, let's say, 80 to 90% of them. And so this is finally going to get Canada to do what it sort of should have done a while back. And I think we're going to see that in other countries as well, that the U.S., what I'd say is the U.S. abdication. By U.S. taking a step or two back, I think other countries will move forward trying to tighten up their other, like protect your flanks. I think that's what we'll see China do with the East Asian countries. I think we'll see even better trade relations with them and Japan. I think that Europe is going to, I mean, what we're seeing, I think, in Europe is really greater economic integration, as well as Europe having a different attitude towards China than the U.S., and especially with some of those countries. I know that sort of fallen out of favor a little bit lately, like Hungary and Slovakia, but they're allowing Chinese direct investment into the EU, even if it's not Germany and France quite yet. But I think that other countries will allow it to happen. And again, so the US really becomes more isolated economically. And I think this is, it'll end up to be, I think, a better thing for global security. having sort of diversifying away from the US and the US consumer. And partly what this means then is if the US is going to be importing less from the world, that means it won't need such large capital flows either. And so that's probably what we're going to see, right? I imagine this is what people are talking about, that the foreign capital leaving the US, US capital leaving the US. So it hasn't been so apparent lately. I think that we had it scare last month. But I'm just pointing out this balance then between the trade account, or the current account, broadly understood, and capital flows. Smaller deficit, if that's the net consequence of the tariffs and lack of containers coming to the US. Smaller trade deficit, it means that the US will need less capital coming in.
What does this all mean for markets then? Because that almost ties into that big picture theme that we've been talking about is capital leaving the US in terms of financial markets, the dollar, bonds, even the markets. However, the markets have come back. You look at the S&P and it's less than 10% away from its all-time highs. It's taken back all of those losses that happened post-Liberation Day. What do you think this all means for capital flows into, or quite frankly, out of the US and overall health of the US markets that have been globally dominant?
Yeah, I think that partly, if I'm right about what's happening, the big picture, I mean, the US brand has become spoiled or soiled, I should say. And I think that means that US companies, this intangible value of a US brand or US company with better returns on investment, superior performances, I think that gets more called into question. I think that I'm nervous about the S&P 500. You know, we talked before, actually in early April, about what kind of bottom we should be looking at. I am surprised how fast it's gotten back up here, but my best guess is we're not really going to get in the S&P 500. We're trading almost 5,700 before the weekend, and I think that not much above 5,800 before we have to turn back down. I am concerned about the broader direction of the economy as well. So cyclical factors, as well as the structural about the U.S. brand. When it comes to the dollar, I think that there could be a little bit more upside for the dollar. Excuse me, I mean this broad correction consolidation phase. I do think there could be a little bit more upside for the greenback. And on interest rates, broadly speaking, no, I think that the Fed really is anchoring the short end of the curve. And so I think that we might get this stronger bouts of inflation, though, and that's really the highlight next week. CPI, both the core and the headline year over year look pretty steady. And that's going to give the Federal Reserve no real reason to be looking for a June rate cut.
Now, if we dive into US stocks, though, especially the large cap stocks, which look led these markets, they do lead these markets because they consume so much capital. In tech, a lot of these large tech companies, they do business in the US, but a lot of their business is also international. Majority is international. And US stocks, a lot of the companies are also very services oriented. And the US has a big trade surplus in terms of trade services. Does that matter if we are just broadly seeing money leave the US? But again, the fact that US stocks, while they're listed in the US, they are global.
Yeah, I think that, you know, that's what some people are doing is looking at those US equity ETFs that are listed in other countries, like in Europe, and trying to come up with some understanding about what's the flows in and out of the US. You know, we've talked about this for a while, but I have been strongly encouraging people in my network to diversify away from the dollar. I've been thinking that the dollar was near a peak and that this was a good time to take advantage of what it seems to be a historically stretched valuation of the dollar and diversify into Japanese and European stocks. And from that might be the big picture, but of course, where the rubber hits the road is where you get in, what sectors you buy. But the idea is that the dollar is very rich. I look for it to weaken. I think that the premium that US companies get is also going to diminish. But this isn't something that's simply like foreign investors. I think this applies to US domestic investors who, because of the superior returns in the US, have come like too concentrated in the US. I think it's still, we haven't really seen a lot of flow data for April, besides what I mentioned, those ETFs. But we have seen perhaps one of the closest things to real time is, as we talked about before, the Federal Reserve acts as a custodian for foreign central banks. And in the last 2 weeks, so that brings us up through May 7th. 2 weeks through May 7th, foreign central banks reduced their treasury holdings by about $27 billion. In the big picture things, it's really just a rounding error. Foreign central banks have roughly $3.27 trillion in these securities, treasury securities and agencies at the Federal Reserve. So there has been some slight movement, but I think again that it's too early just to think that this is a capital strike against the US, especially given how fast the stock markets come back and that the US dollar just made, say, 2 to 3 week highs against many of the major currencies yesterday, even though there wasn't really follow through ahead of the weekend.
So, because everything is happening so fast in terms of market and capital flows, even on the tariff front, yes, tariffs are announced and they're pulled back, then they're delayed, then some are put in. There's so much volatility going on out there. What's a reasonable time frame in your eyes for us to then put a bookmark in and say, okay, what is happening now? What are the trends that we are seeing that could be longer lasting rather than these month to month, even week to week moves?
Yeah, I think that the move's begun already, but I think that we've had a correction. I think this is the hard thing, right? Is that if you think about how the markets operate, is they don't fall in a straight line. I mean, we're lucky. I think that we had a period a few weeks ago where maybe Sterling was up for almost 10 days in a row. These are unusual streaks. So I think that what we're having is this, like, it's like a more of a step function. We're walking downstairs. And so you'd expect to see the next high to be lower than the previous high and have lower lows, lower highs, sort of the definition of a downtrend. And so I think the US stock market, if it had, I think it's peaked already. I think that the dollar's peak is behind us as well. And so I mean, that's the kind of environment I think we're going to be in. I think I'm concerned that, too bad Chad's not on the call, but we've been talking about how so many people have been talking about recession. And I'm still concerned that we still could be on the precipice and that we should know in the next couple of months. So by the end of July, because think about what happens in July, we only get June economic data. And sometime then in the July economic, in the data we get for the month of June and in July, I think we're going to see a sharp slowdown in the economy, a weaker labor market. And that ultimately is what's going to get the Federal Reserve to cut rates again, is not inflation is going to be in target. I'm still worried about the upside of inflation. But if the Federal Reserve sees rising unemployment, they will conclude that inflation is not going to go up much higher, that the weakness of the economy is going to cap inflation.
All right. Hey, Mark, great comments. Thank you so much for wrapping up this weekend show. There's just so much for us to take in on the economic and market side of things. And again, who knows how this is all going to play out, but there is this growing narrative that the US is in for some tough times. And also the consumer is in for some tough times as we start to see some inventories dry up. Boy, oh boy, it's a lot for us to take in week after week, but it also gives us a lot to talk about. So everyone, please be sure to visit our website, podcast, YouTube channel, and also follow us on Twitter or X and on Substack. That's where you can keep up to date with all of our daily editorials and company updates from throughout the week, as well as extended interviews for the weekend show. Again, Mark Chandler, managing partner at Bannockburn Global Forex, also editor of the Mark to Market website. Be sure to click that link in the show notes. Mark, great chatting with you on this weekend show. And everyone, thanks for tuning in. I hope you all have a great rest of your weekend.
Thanks. Good luck to everybody.
The Corlin Economics Report is produced for A.B. Corlin and Associates. Opinions expressed on this program are intended solely for the entertainment of our listeners, do not constitute investment advice, and are not necessarily those of this network, radio station, or our sponsors. Find out more about this program and today's guests by visiting www.kereport.com. For Al Corlin, this is Colleen Robbins. Join us again next week for the Corlin Economics Report.